Okay, so this evening, we're happy to have with us two of our esteemed alumni who work as undergraduate majors, Janae Tally Jackson and Andre Brown Jr. They both were a part of our DAS history, and we're happy to have them here tonight to discuss with us about their experiences as DAS undergrads and also their experiences with study abroad. So I'd like to turn this over to Ashley Marie Hayes, who will be doing the initial conducting of the interviews.
Thank you so much. Thank you both for being here this evening. My first question for you is, as two people who came from predominantly Black cities, why did you choose U of M?
Rumi, I can jump in on this one first. And I have to, oh, some of my favorite people are from Flint. I miss you, man. Okay. But I am from Detroit. And okay, I have to expose myself. I actually wanted to go to Howard University. And my mother was like, nope, private institution. Who's paying for that? I don't even have the money to get you back and forth for the holidays. Like, she was very practical. And so I had to reconsider my options. And when I thought about other institutions, there was really none other that could match what the University of Michigan had to offer, particularly for an in-state institution. And so I had advocates at my high school who thought it would be a great opportunity for me and, you know, were really pushing me toward applying. And growing up in Detroit, like every year you're visiting the University of Michigan with your school is just what is done with Detroit public schools. So over the years, I had also been able to visit campus, meet students, and learn more about the organization, and so, or the institution rather. So I think all of those things, you know, high school teachers and counselors advocating for me, thinking it would be a good opportunity, and visiting myself all over the years, just learning more about it. I think that was what helped me get to Michigan.
And I think for me, so I'm from Flint. And I think my coming to Michigan was sort of happenstance in a lot of ways. So I also wanted to go to Howard as well. And I also was looking at a few other schools out of state. But as a first generation student, or soon to be first generation student at that time, I really didn't have much guidance or direction on like which schools were good and which ones I should apply to. And I just was kind of applying to schools. And so I had gotten into Michigan State. And then I also had applied to and gotten into Michigan. I also, similar to Janae, had been to campus quite a bit. I was in the King Chavez Parks program when I was a middle schooler. So I came to Michigan for the first time in the eighth grade. And then I also was a part of the Model UN program when I was in high school. And so we had a Model UN competition. I think that was my 10th grade year at Michigan. And so, you know, again, I applied. I knew I was going to college as a high schooler, but didn't really know where. And what really sold me, to be quite honest, is that I just thought Michigan's campus was beautiful. I remember being in the Law Quad and just kind of walking around and seeing everything. And just, it was so different than what I was used to just growing up 45 minutes away in Flint. And it just was sort of a decision that I made. I didn't know how, you know, good Michigan was as a school. My counselor, go to Michigan. Who was like 4 years older than me was the one previous to that. So that was just kind of how it happened. And it was a really great decision that I didn't know I was making at the time.
Both of your stories are quite relatable for me from Southfield. So I appreciate your perspectives and sharing that. It's very encouraging to know I'm not the only one that just applied because I heard of Michigan or was told to go to Michigan's campus because my school took me every year. So thanks for sharing your responses. When did you both arrive at U of M as a student, and what did you study?
So I came the fall of 2001, so August something, it was a Wednesday. I remember that my uncle helped me move down with my family. I came right before classes started. I think at the time they were having freshmen move in about a week before classes started. And so I moved in. I lived in North Campus. I lived in Bursley. I was there all 3 years that I lived on campus. And at the time, again, I didn't know much about where to live. And people were like, you live on North Campus. And I wasn't an engineer. I wasn't a music major. I wasn't, you know, the folks who tend to live on North Campus, but it was actually sort of a vibrant Black campus or community on North Campus as well. And so when I originally came to Michigan, I was going to be a sports and entertainment attorney. That was my goal. My whole life, I wanted to be a lawyer. Everyone was like, oh, you like to argue, you should be a lawyer. And so I was planning to be a psychology major because there was no like pre-law major. And I was planning to major in psych. And then eventually, as I decided that I wanted to be a sports and entertainment attorney, I transferred my sophomore year from LSNA into the School of Kinesiology to be a sports management major. And then right after that, I did my study abroad, and I'll talk, I guess, a little bit more about that later in the study abroad section. But sort of going to South Africa really changed my professional trajectory. And I decided to go into public health. But because I was already so far along, I was not going to change my major and stay in school any longer than I had to. And so I ended up staying a sports management major, minoring in CAS, you know, to sort of stay in LSNA. And that's sort of my transition from psych to kines to public health, essentially.
And I also came to Michigan in fall of 2001. And what a blessing. Andre was one of the first people I met on campus, one of the first friends I made. We were walking to what was, I don't know what the Trotter House on Washtenaw is now, but we were walking to then what we knew as the Trotter House.
And, it's Greek Life now. It's the office of Greek Life. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we were going for a Black Welcome Week event, I think like a comedy show. And so we met each other walking. Yay.
Yes. I have on a Black Welcome Week t-shirt. I'm president. This is from 2019. So that was a little fun tidbit. Okay.
Legacy. Yeah. I've been friends with this man for 20 years. This is what Black Welcome Week will do for you.
Yes. Right. Come on.
But yeah, I came in the fall of 2001 and I went to a high school in Detroit that I feel like people would be like, oh, it's selective or whatever. Obviously, since I've left, it's not as great, of course, because I'm not there. But I do think that there was a little bit of like kind of nose up. You have to pick these majors and future careers that sound awesome. And so I also was like, oh, I'm going to be pre-law. I didn't even know fully what that meant. Like I thought there was a pre-law major and you did it and then you went to law school. Like I didn't understand, you know, what it meant to be pre-law, but that was certainly what I was telling everyone. And so then I got to campus and at some point, I honestly don't remember where things shifted. I developed some interest in architecture. And so I was like, okay, I am going to pursue architecture. Woo, that was fun. So freshman year, the first semester, I took calculus and physics together. And in my mind, I'm like, I'm smart. I took hard classes together in high school. This is going to be nothing. Kicked my butt. But those were prerequisites to get into the architecture school. And so I was like, okay, it was a rough semester. I just needed to transition. I then took an intro to architecture course second semester. It was a flaming hot mess. That was not my ministry. Quickly realized that. But all the while, every semester I was taking a CAS course. So the first semester I took a history of art class was my favorite class that semester. And I don't remember what I took the second semester, but I just always knew I wanted to take a CAS class every semester. And every year of doing that, I slowly began to realize like, these are the classes I'm most interested in, most passionate about, most committed to. I really want to see, you know, what would come of me doing this as my major. So that was more so just really, it was, I felt like I belonged. I was very interested in the classes. And so it just kind of happened for me that I ended up being a CAS major.
Thank y'all both for sharing those exhilarating stories of coming to Michigan for the first time as a student. Can you describe your earliest experiences with the then Center for Afro-American and African Studies as a student? Oh, you're muted. You're muted, Andre.
Sorry about that. I think at the time when we were freshmen, CAS had a really good relationship with the Black Student Union, and BSU was sort of my liaison or introduction to CAS. So oftentimes the BSU did a lot of programming with CAS, so we co-programmed together. And then also, Beth was very instrumental in terms of being sort of a unofficial advisor to BSU. So, in terms of, guiding us, telling us what happened in the 70s and how it's the same as it is, at our, 30 years later and sort of giving us that wisdom. And then also we had a lot of our programs or events in the CAS Center. So in the library or in the common space, I can't remember what it was called, but at the time we were in
West Hall.
West Hall, so under the arch, the little engineering arch as you're coming out of the Diag, right there. So, real cozy. That's the way I'm going to put it. It was real cozy. but it was also it was just homey. I think coziness added to just kind of the comfort, the family and familiarity that you were able to build there. And so we were there. And I think at the end of my freshman year was when CAS was moving from West Hall to Haven Hall, where you all are now. And people were actually really upset about moving out of West Hall. They're like
hotter than fish grease. You hear me? Because, I was hot.
Because it was like, it was, again, it just kind of added to that like African diasporic feel. It's this like rich wood and, and then we're moving over to this like modern at the time office looking building. I'm like, this is not CAS. This is, and so people were really upset about that at the time. But again, it was because we love CAS. It was our home and it was a safe space for us. It continued to be that when we moved to Haven Hall. But certainly from the time that I got to campus and started getting involved with the Black community, CAS was a very instrumental part of that experience.
Yeah, I mean, literally ditto what he said. My first memories are of West Hall and of the murals that Professor Lockhart had painted and just the feeling you got when you were there, both because of the environment and the people. And I remember, and again, similarly, I was very involved with the Black Student Union from early on. Like, it just immediately hit me like, wow, this is a very different experience coming from an essentially all Black high school and being here. Something in me immediately said, I need to find my people in my space. And so for me, that was through the Black Student Union. And so again, so many programs and partnerships with CAS brought me to that space. And you just, once you're there, you just fall in love with it. Even if you're just hanging out or we're having meetings, we were always there. And so I remember, I just can vividly see like the murals and the artwork. And I was one of those people who was really upset about the move. And I feel like even with, Trotter, I certainly did not enjoy that walk to Trotter every Thursday night for Black Student Union meetings, especially not in the winter. Listen, okay, the winter time, you take you out. You found out the real members in the winter time, okay? Yeah, exactly. Seven of us in there. But
in there, talking about Ashe, right?
But it was, I think that's just how Black people are. We find a way to make something magical and beautiful out of everything. And I think people were trying to sell us on, West Hall is off the beaten path, it's kind of further out. You're moving to Haven Hall where all the other departments are. You're kind of centralizing your location. To me, trying to argue that it was more accessible in certain ways where I was fine with kind of being off to ourselves and doing our own thing and really owning the space. So yeah, I digress, but yeah.
I would say, I think, you know, in sort of looking now as a real adult, you know, back on the experience, I think it really was that was a safe space for us. And mm-hmm. I, you know, when we were in West Hall, like you really were removed from everyone, the rest of the university. And it really was just kind of this whole other world where it was just Black. Mm-hmm. Black professors, Black imagery on the wall, Black literature available in the libraries and things like that. And I think, again, to have that be exposed, because that's essentially what happened when we went to Haven Hall. Now we're around everyone, mm-hmm. around the sort of the comfort of being insulated from the rest of the university was not there, at least in a physical form. And I think that did make a difference.
Definitely.
Thank you all for that insight into that. It kind of segues to our next question, which is, what is the importance of an Africana Studies program at a predominantly white university for undergraduate students?
So I would say that, I don't know, I have so many responses to this, but I'll keep it to a couple. And one is that for me, I feel like I really strengthened my sense of self and confidence in who I am and my identity at CAS. I think that I kind of took for granted that growing up in Detroit, going to all Black schools, it was just, I mean, you didn't really talk about it because it just, what, we were fish in the water. Like, you don't talk about the water because you're there. And so then getting to U of M and, you know, being there during the time of the affirmative action cases and being the only Black person in your classes. And it's like, huh, okay, well, this is certainly something to think about. So for me, it was really about learning about who I am, learning about my people, about the culture, and just really feeling strong and positive about that. It was also one of the first times where the narrative of our people did not start with slavery. Like, it was kind of revolutionary to me. Like, you know, the trashy history that you get taught in public schools is like, and Black people rise out from slavery and here we are. And it's like, no, like, we are a whole people way before all of that effery, you know? So like, just learning from professors who look like me sometimes, and then also learning like using literature and reading books from authors who look like me, reclaiming that story and not having someone else tell it for you or to you and just, you know, expecting you to accept it and keep it moving. I think it was that ownership piece too, that I feel like is why it's so essential to have Africana Studies programs at universities. And when I hear that, I'm not saying it out of shock, but just kind of disgust that we still have stories coming out of, you know, states in the middle of this country who are either not teaching certain aspects of history or are it's revisionist history and they're making things up, or, you know, we're not going to celebrate Black History Month. All of these things that come out just reinforces why we need these types of programs.
And I think similar to what Janae said, I think, you know, for me, having an Africana Studies program, one, provides context. I think it helped me to understand my experiences as a Black person who grew up really poor in Flint, and understanding the social structures that exist that made that possible. And I think that, you know, it was not something that I was able to sort of conceive of. I remember when I came in as a freshman, and we were having a conversation at BSU, and it was about affirmative action. And one of the comments that I made at the time was that I thought that affirmative action was a handout to Black people. Now, like, you know, pushing 40-year-old Andre now is like super appalled that something like that ever came out of my mouth. But again, when you grow up in an environment where you're told that if you're not successful, it's your fault, it's a personal failure, or it's a familial one, you know, something that's limited to your family unit, you buy into those things when you don't have any sort of counter narrative to that. And being able to learn in all of the different CAS classes, whether it was a history class or a literature class or an environmental class, for example, all of those things helped me to understand the Black condition and why Black people are where they are at that moment in time and where we continue to be. And so it really helped me to just understand not only just Blackness in its full complexity and not just kind of like hood Black, you know, from Flint that I learned, but, you know, diasporic Blackness, light-skinned Blackness, you know, bougie, rich Blackness, and sort of all of those things were possible because I had this opportunity. I think the other thing for me that cast what it did for a lot of people is that it helped us to know that we belong. That, you know, our history, our academics, all of the things that we learn in our classes are important from the Black perspective as well. And we've contributed to this country just as much, maybe even more than other people. And I think it's sometimes hard to see that, especially when you're in this, competitive university. As Janae said, you might be the only Black person up in your class or one of a few, and the other Black person might not like other Black people. So it really is a struggle, and you can feel like that you don't belong, that, you know, you're not supposed to be here. And those are things that continue to be, challenging. And so when you have this entire body of work of an academic unit that essentially tells you that you belong, that your stories are important, that what you want to do, your career aspirations are doable, all of those things really help to, you know, shore up your confidence as a student, but it also helps to give you guidance in terms of where you're going, for your life and career.
Thank you both so very much. And before I pass it off to Tara, I want to ask, before we get too far into the study abroad questions, is what drew you both to DAS and to your respective study abroad experiences? And if you feel you touched on coming to DAS already, you don't have to reiterate that, but what drew you to your experiences that you've had? And then we'll get more into study abroad with Tara.
So I think I may have covered that. It's so weird to call it DAS. I know, like, it's just, I'm like, it's CAS.
That was an argument you like. That was the move was a debate, and CAS to DAS was a debate.
Yeah, so, I'm just definitely. Like, yeah. I mean, again, I'll just say it was home for a lot of different reasons. And so that was the reason that drew me into staying with CAS, you know, until I graduated and 9 years later, still coming back. As regards the study abroad program, so I don't know if AIDS and Black and Brown is still a thing. Is it still a thing? So my freshman year, there was a program called AIDS and Black and Brown. It was designed to raise HIV awareness among Black and Latino students on campus. And at the time, towards the end of my freshman year, the two women who were running the program, who were like the chairs, were graduating seniors. And so we needed somebody to take it over because it needed to happen again or what have you. And so, you know, being young and excitable and wanting to do something and just too much time on my hands, Panther, who was the speaker of the BSU at the time, was like, oh, you should do this, and basically told me to do it. So I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And so that meant meeting with Beth pretty regularly. I think we met every week, from that time on, sometimes early in the morning. That's how you know I love Beth and I love the work, because I was getting up, coming from North Campus, meeting at like 8 something in the morning.
I was going to say, you were so regular. He met Friday at 8 in the morning.
In doing the AIDS and Black and Brown program, it allowed me to interface with a lot of other student organizations, and then also faculty who were doing HIV prevention work. And one of them was Nisha Hanif. And so once I heard about the study abroad program, like, I was excited. I'm like, oh, I want to do this, because it was in line with, it was an HIV prevention focused study abroad program. So I was excited about that. Don't ever tell Nisha, but I really wanted to go to South Africa. really, really bad. And so that was a huge motivation for me. I'm like, ooh, I can go to South Africa. And so I was really excited about that opportunity as well. And then Nisha actually didn't want me to go because she told me I was too young. I was a sophomore. And most of the people who went were, I guess, rising juniors. Is that the correct term? Anyways, they're in their junior year. And so I was like a year too young. And she's like, oh, you need to wait. And I'm like, no, I'm ready now. Like, I'm running this whole week of programs. Like, I got all this, like, social justice and, you know, Black history knowledge or what have you. So eventually was able to talk her into letting me go.
On I had to vouch for you.
I see. Look, Beth always looking out. Let me tell you. And so, and just in doing, still doing the AIDS and Black and Brown work, which I continue to chair the committee until I graduated, was really an opportunity, for me, and it is why it drew me in, because it was an opportunity to do the kind of work that I was doing, in another country, and to learn, a lot more. I mean, it was such an amazing experience, but that's how I got into the study abroad program.
Yeah, so I think for me, it was a couple things. The first was that when you, I always tell people, and it's funny because when I tell people I go to Michigan, they're like, do you know such and such? Because it's just this thing that like all the Black people knew each other, you know, like, so there's a family that comes out of you being Black at Michigan. And I watched Andre and other friends, you know, upperclassmen who I was close with go and do study abroad. Kristen Harris was actually the person who really convinced me to pursue the study abroad that I did. Dr. Kristen Harris Wanienwu. Let me put some respect on that name. So I just learning about their experiences and seeing their excitement and how powerful their stories were got me interested. I also think that being in the Black Student Union and all of us really trying to focus on, you know, what does it mean to embrace the diaspora, wanting to broaden my perspective. And I absolutely was one of those people who had the complete wrong perception of what it meant to visit the country of Africa. And I'm doing some scare quotes here because that happens all the time, right? It's just this, you know, one experience that people claim to have, and it's often negative and horrible. And I remember actually the first time that I brought it up to my parents, mind you, I'm in college, so you know, you think you're grown. And my mother flat out was like, no, she was like, it's not safe, it's dangerous, you're gonna die, you can't go. She shut it down. And so I, you know, kind of like very scared because, you know, my Black mama, I was like, I'm going to listen, but I'm going next year. And that's how it happened that I think I was a junior when I applied to go to Ghana with Professor Schaeffers. And it was such a powerful experience, which is also something that I guess I'll share more in the following questions. Just, you know, what's so great about DAS and the study abroad is just how, you know, the cross-departmental relationships and how you get to experience a lot of different things. So I actually was the only student to go with a group of urban planning students. So it was a really great experience. But yeah, just that interest in the diaspora and also seeing my other friends do study abroad is what brought me to it.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, Janae, it's so funny because I now that you say that, I just think back to how hesitant my parents were about letting me go. It was right, you know, it was like post September 11th. And so things were still kind of crazy. And I think there was like some other planes or bombings or something that had happened on the continent as well, right before I left. And so it was a lot of sort of international turmoil in the midst of sort of going on this trip. And so it did take some resolve because I know my parents were like, are you sure? And you want to go later? And I'm just like, no. I'm gonna go. And so,
yeah. Cool. Thanks so much. So I'll continue with the study abroad questions. And also just to say, Janae, when you were talking about sort of why DAS was or CAS was important to you and why it needed to exist, it reminded me of, I've just been looking through some interview footage from a panel from 1980, where which featured the students
who were involved in BAM, BAM One, mm-hmm. The student activism that led to the formation of CAS. And I just came mm-hmm. across a clip with Ron, I think his name was Ron Harris, who was a member of BAM. And he said one of the driving factors was that he went to the head of the history department. He said, we need to do more Black history. And the history department head said, but what is there except slaves in America? And he said, well, Black history is about so much more than slaves in America.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, it's interesting that generations of students, you know, have been fighting for that, to carve out that space.
Absolutely.
And I think also just like we're more than Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and, you know, and no shade or slight to them, because they certainly are worthy of, you know, all the accolades that they get in the history books. But we're so rich, and they're so, I mean, like Black people are just dope all over the world, and we're resilient, and you would not know that. And especially, again, I think coming from a very economically depressed Black city that, you know, that I come from, you would just never know all of the amazing things that Black people mm-hmm. have accomplished, because the narrative is always poverty, violence, you know, broken families. And so to be able to just know that there's all of this wonder out there that we've accomplished was just such, I mean, it's indescribable how enriching it is. And to say that it's life-changing is not an overstatement or not an exaggeration at all. It really did change my life.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So two kind of those points. I'm interested to hear more about your experiences with study abroad at DAS specifically, because I know like DAS is, when people talk about study abroad at DAS, it was different from how study abroad was run in other programs. And I'm interested to hear more about your experiences. I know you began to touch on them, but maybe tell us more.
Sure, I can start. And I, so as an undergrad, I went to Ghana with Professor Schaffers. And then as a grad student, I went to South Africa with Professor Lori Hill. And, you know, a huge part of the experience was shaped and is treasured to me because of the leaders of the trips. And I just felt so fortunate to be able to have that amount of time with those professors. And again, I was a DAS major, but I was still taking other prerequisites. And for the most part, you know, I didn't always have professors who looked like me. So I valued that. That was so powerful and important to me. So number one, just the experience of being able to have these very in-depth, you know, you go out the country with folks for 3 and 4 weeks and it gets real close and personal. So just being able to have those experiences and really for Professor Schaffers, every interaction with him is literally like a let me sit at your feet and learn. Every single thing he says to me is like a learning moment, and I just cherish it. So to know that, you know, these great minds of our time are like leading these groups, it was really powerful. The other thing was, again, like I kind of mentioned, the experiences stand out for me because so much of what I knew about the continent was fed to me by media, by people who were, I think, ignorant and just didn't know about the beauty, the richness, and the complexities, diversity of everything that was happening there. And so to be able to go and experience it for myself was certainly very powerful and life-changing. So I'll stop there and pass it over to Rumi.
Yeah, so I just want to make sure I'm answering just what was my general experience or what did I love about it? I want to make sure I'm answering. Oops, sorry, I can't hear you. I didn't hear you. No, I still can't hear you.
I know she did say general experience while she's trying to work through her sound.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, I can read lips.
I'll talk about that. So I think one of the really great things that I didn't love at the time that I was going through it, but I think that was really helpful. So we had class the semester leading up to the study abroad. So I think we had class like once or twice a week or something. We had to read books and articles and things like Nelson Mandela's Long Walk to Freedom was one of the pieces that we had to read. And so what it really did, those classes beforehand, and we continue to have classes during the study abroad. So, you know, a couple of times during the evening, the week, we will have class wherever we were staying. And it really helped to contextualize the country and the people. And so as Janae said, you know, you get the like starving baby with the big belly and the flies flying around him on TV, and everyone lives in a hut, and you know, and that's basically kind of the image of Africa wherever on the continent that you get. But reading those books, reading those stories, learning the history, understanding the people's struggle really helped to make the country make sense before we got there, and then we were there working with people, doing, you know, delivering the module that we were there to teach people about. All of those things made a whole lot of sense because we had that sort of prerequisite training about who we were going to be dealing with, for a lack of a better words. And I think to me that shows such a respect for the people, for South African people, for the South African country. And it set a tone for what we were there to do. Like, we were there to, yes, help, yeah, to learn, yeah, to have a great time and all of that, and, you know, and see South Africa. But we were here to, you know, do some serious social justice work. And so those sort of pre-learning experiences really helped with that. And then I just think, you know, for me, going to South Africa, even though like I'm from Flint is a predominantly Black city, to just go and get off the plane and see that both of the pilots are Black. You know, all of the billboards, everybody Black on them. And like, you know, folks working from every level, from the janitor all the way up to executives, wherever we were at, were Black people, was something that I just was not used to seeing. And it was such a, like, again, moment of wonder, like, oh my God. And I think that, you know, when I stepped off the plane in Johannesburg, I just felt at home. Like, I felt peace. I felt calm. It just felt, you know, I felt connected. And so I think that, you know, it really helped to set the tone for what that experience was going to be like. I think the other thing that we had heard as Black Americans was like, oh, Black Africans don't like y'all, and all these sort of negative things about us. And some of them are, there's some elements of truth, because I've certainly experienced some sort of negative interactions with, you know, African Americans or first generations, but it just was not the truth. People were warm, people were welcoming, people were excited to see you. People are amazed that you're an American and a Black American at that. I know one of the things that, especially the kids, all thought that we knew, like, all the celebrities. Sorry, like 50 Cent, he's trash, but whatever. At the time, he was pretty new and popular in terms of American music. And so all of the kids wanted to know if we knew 50 Cent, or, you know, how we were Black, but we didn't speak Zulu, for example. And so just all of these, you know, experiences that, you know, first, because we were able to have those folks humanized in our eyes, I think opened us up to, you know, be, have as full of experience during our study abroad.
How about now?
Yes.
Yay.
Okay, good. I've never had that problem with my audio before. I guess there's a first.
Welcome to Zoom. You must be lucky, because I've certainly had to sign out of my class a few times and sign back in like, y'all, I'll be back, because I'm just having a moment. I'm tired of Zoom. Zoom tired of me. This probably...
That's what happens. Zoom tired of me. Yeah, it was really interesting to hear your reflections, especially Andrea in South Africa, coming from there myself. Mm-hmm. I'm from Cape Town, but I know what you mean about Joburg as well. Joburg and Durban, these cities have a different feel.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I wondered if you could talk, both of you, a little bit more about perhaps some of the specific projects or events in both of your study abroads that jump out at you as particularly kind of memorable experiences.
Sure, I can go first. So I think the most poignant moment for me, and there were a lot of just, again, amazing, interesting, soul-shaking moments, but I think the one that really sticks out for me is that, so we, in our study abroad, we started in Johannesburg. We were there for about 4 or 5 days. We went to Durban. We were in Durban for about three and a half weeks. And then we spent like the last week of our time in Cape Town. So the majority of our time was spent in Durban and kind of the townships around Durban. And so our job, what we were there to do, Nisha had developed this module that talks about how HIV is spread, how to prevent HIV. So it was essentially sort of a an oral HIV prevention module that we were delivering, and then having teachbacks to happen to us. But one of the other experiences that we had was that we had an opportunity to go to this place called McCord Hospital. And so it was in Durban, in the city of Durban, and it served mostly mothers, or at least what we saw at the time when we were there were mothers and then babies and children who were living with HIV. So pediatric cases as well. And so we had an opportunity. They were having a support group, just so happened the day that we were there, and we were invited to sit in on the support group. And so it was, so again, like by this time I've been doing AIDS and Black and Brown for like a year and a half, you know, talking about using condoms and safer sex and, you know, fighting HIV stigma and, you know, all of these things that I, you know, been talking about. But being in that support group, so we were able to kind of just sit around the perimeter. They were sitting in a circle in this room. It's a pretty huge room. And there were probably, I would say, about 30 people who were part of this support group. So it was moms with their babies and things like that. And so we kind of came in. It's, you know, it's warm. It's stuffy in the room or what have you. But this was the first time that I could say that I had seen people in person who were sick living with HIV. And so before it was just kind of like, you know, healthy folks, you know, they're taking their meds and things like that. And so in this very kind of privileged American context, but then to be in this room and to be like literally like a foot or so maybe away from folks who were visibly ill, babies could tell were in distress because of their illness or what have you. I felt so uncomfortable. Like I can't even express to you how uncomfortable I felt in that moment. I, you know, all the sort of the ideas around the stigma and like, oh, let me recoil away from people, like all of that welled up in me. And then there's, again, and there's like the baby's crying and people are talking and it's hot. And it's like, I mean, it's like a sensory overload that's going on. And so very quickly, honestly, like I would say in probably like 2 minutes, I had to work through all of that. And I had to be like, this is the work, right? Like, that kind of privileged, flowery, woo, kind of like you see those drug commercials on TV and they're all running around happy and stuff, but telling you about all these deadly things that are going to happen. Like, that's kind of how I felt. I was like, no, this is really serious. This is what the work can look like. This is what the extreme of the work looks like. And I can't very well, you know, sit on my soapbox and talk to people about stigma and all of that, and then be in this space where I'm really put to the test and fail. And that's what I felt like that I was going to do if I wasn't able to quickly work through my own stuff to be in the moment to experience HIV in all of its capacity and all of the ways in which it happens. And so that was just something that I had to do. And I'm so glad that I did it. I'm so glad that I didn't just kind of like panic and like run out the room or, you know, something like that. But it really, you know, like I said, there were a lot of things that I remember about that trip, but I can just still feel myself in the room and hear all of the things that were going on. And that was such a powerful moment for me because I think it helped me to gain a greater level of compassion that I needed to really be effective at doing HIV prevention work.
Yeah. The other one I'm thinking of with you, Andre, is also when we were at Robben Island and we both got kind of overwhelmed.
Yeah.
That was a moment as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think for me, one of the challenges that I have, I don't want to say it's like a challenge overall because I think it's served me well. I'm very curious as a person. And so I like to know why stuff happens. It's just, and sometimes to a fault, you know, like ask about my, you know, past relationships and why they ended, right? I'm like, oh, I don't know why. But I think one of the things for me always is that related to that is around racism. And I just never get why Black people are treated so terribly. And it makes no sense. It's not warranted for any reason. And one of the things about the Robben Island trip was that when we went into the sort of bunker area where, you know, the inmates were housed and things like that, they have on the wall this big like metal board, and it shows like basically that they fed the white people more than the colored people, more than the Black people. So it's like a whole cascade, like the white people got 3 pieces of bread, you know, somebody got 2, and then the Black people got crumbs. And it was, I just couldn't wrap my mind around how people had gotten so depraved to think that that was the way in which you should treat another human being. And so I couldn't get over that. And so the emotions of it all were very strong. And I think it just, again, brought back so many things of just my own experiences at home, thinking about Black American history, thinking about diasporic history. And I think it just really continues to be something that I struggle with. It's like why we are treated the way that we are. And that was such a hard thing for me to be able, and then such a, again, a very stark visualization of it, definitely.
Yeah. I will say, I'll probably talk more about when I went to South Africa and I was a grad student at the time. And that was just such a great experience. And I failed to mention, so number one, I second everything Andre said about just the intentionality that DAS has around preparing students before they go. And so our course was, I think it was called From Detroit to Durban. So there was this kind of deep dive into Detroit and the culture there. And even growing up in Detroit, I went to places that I either had heard about but never been to or just hadn't even heard about. And so being able to learn more about Detroit history was very powerful and kind of juxtaposing it to our experience in South Africa broadly. And so when we went, I think ours was shorter than Andre. So we were there, I think maybe like, you know, 3.5 weeks, something like that. And so we spent about a week in each city, in Cape Town, in Johannesburg, and in Durban. And in every place we went, we always visited elementary schools or primary schools. And my background is in youth development. And at the time, you know, the time that we went, I was planning for like a summer program for my middle school and high school students. So education has always been interesting and important to me. And I would see, you know, they intentionally planned for us to visit a school with Black children, a school with colored children, and a school for white African children. And just to see the differences in resources and in everything, really. It was so hard. And obviously, you know, the passion was there regardless of if the resources weren't there. You know, you could feel the love, you could feel the ingenuity, you could feel the creativeness to like make a way out of no way in those spaces. you could just feel that positive energy, but it was so frustrating to see why. And you knew it was because of color, the differences that children were experiencing. And so it also blew my mind that I feel like that's the same thing that happens in America, and particularly that happens in Detroit. So that was a lot of what I focused on. We all had to decide on the topic that we were going to write on. We didn't have a project per se while we were there. It was really about just going around and experiencing, you know, having class and experiencing all of these different institutions and organizations. And when we got back, deciding on a topic to write on. And so I focused a lot on the youth development piece and how important it is to have that positive sense of self. Honestly, what I feel like I gained as a cast baby is, you know, we can't build up our young people if, you know, they are starting in these places where it is so obvious that people think they are less than or that they're not worthy. And so how do we build that in them, even when the universe, or not the universe, but when, you know, society says otherwise? So that was a lot of what my paper focused on, and still obviously, you know, something that I'm really interested in is how do we strengthen young Black people to say, regardless of what society says, you are worthy, you are beautiful, you are all of the great things, you know, in spite of.
Mm-hmm. That's so true, Janae. I was thinking of the same thing, because being a librarian in Detroit working with youth versus being a youth librarian in Ann Arbor, I could see the same dichotomies I saw in South Africa. And it just stunned me, because we're supposed to be living in this new country that is supposedly evolved from moving away from what, you know, is supposed to be a something different. And yet seeing the exact same thing, the parallel universe staring us right in the face, it's still very difficult for me to reconcile.
Yeah. And I think the same is true for HIV and risk, and why, you know, HIV is so out of control in Black communities here, as well as in South Africa as well. And so, you know, you look at racism and poverty, and sort of all of these, what, you know, now I know is, you know, in the field of public health, we call social determinants of health. But at that time, we didn't really have the language for it. But it's just basically your experience, where you live and where you work and where you go to school. And all of these things sort of form this constellation of risk, because those places and institutions have been systemically, broken down and handicapped in a lot of ways. And so I think the same thing, you know, you're saying that you saw parallels in the educational system, mm-hmm. you also see in the healthcare and HIV prevention world as well. It's the same thing in a different place, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my last question around study abroad is to ask how those programs in DAS impacted your career trajectory and your life since. So you could answer that now, or we can bundle that into a question that Beth's going to ask as well, about more generally how DAS has shaped your life experiences after university. Shall we do that, Beth? I don't want to take up too much of their time with all these specific questions.
You're on mute.
You're on mute.
That's perfect. Okay. Since you've asked it, then we'll just bundle that into the question itself.
So I will say my study abroad experience and just my training in CAS are a direct influence on my career choices. As I said earlier, I was going to be a lawyer. That was my plan. I was going to law school afterwards. I had actually never heard of public health before until I started with the study abroad program, and Leslie Welch, who was one of the, I don't want to call her a chaperone, but a graduate assistant. That's probably a better way to put it. Leslie was a MPH, a Master's of Public Health student at the time. I knew Leslie from, again, just doing work around AIDS and Black and Brown, and then also just being in CAS. And so I was able to learn a lot about what public health was, the flexibility in terms of the different trajectories that one can take in public health. And it really helped me to see that all of the things that I've been learning in the Black Student Union, learning in my CAS classes around the Black experience, around institutional structures and how they influence social outcomes, all of them were a direct result of my training. And so when I came back from the study abroad, I decided that I was going to go and get an MPH. And so without CAS, without the study abroad program and being able to interact with all of the people that I did throughout that process, I would be somebody's lawyer right now. So it definitely changed my life and in my career trajectory.
Yeah, absolutely. So as a CAS major, I always got the question of, oh, so what are you going to do with that major? You know, there wasn't respect or value placed on, in my experience, deciding to major in CAS or DAS. And so for me, I feel like, you know, it was such a foolish question. Like, what do you mean? The same thing that you're going to do with your degree, because it's just as worthy. And I learned so many practical skills, you know, critical thinking and strength in my writing. I had some professors lay me out like, girl, you've got to step it up and tighten it up. So I learned so much, you know, just practically. But I think for me, it really helped shape who I am and the work that I'm passionate about, that at the heart of what I do and what I want to do is lean into relationships, connecting with people, doing my part to it. You know, it's that interconnectedness that I think I really deepened with my relationships at CAS. So it's not just enough for me to do well, but what can I do? Because it's absolutely my responsibility to connect with others and figure out how all of us do better. And those types of beliefs that, you know, lead my life, like Andre said, that helped me decide my career path, that was shaped at CAS and just, you know, being a part of a community that was so nurturing and so safe at a time where being at the university and being Black did not always feel good. And so it also instilled in me, like, how do I create these spaces for other people, you know, and just continue that love and continue that care for other people, particularly for people in my community.
Yeah, and I would say everything I've learned has been so useful because, you know, my work is around why Black gay men have HIV more than other folks and why we are depressed more than other folks as well. And a lot of those things have to do with our experiences as Black men in general. And then also on top of that, sort of that intersectional perspective of being gay or bisexual as well. But being able, again, from learning how to understand how social structures are built and sustained, essentially understanding white supremacy and patriarchy and how they operate in many different ways in our society are all things that I learned in CAS that mm-hmm. I've been able to translate into now in the public health realm. So even though it was a more generalized training around African and African studies, the things that I learned about how, you know, societies are structured and who has access to opportunities has been something that has clearly guided me, through my work. Because again, as a sports management major, like, I don't do anything.
We knew you. We were just waiting for you to say that, you know. Wasn't going to happen.
Well, because, no, people actually tried to talk me out of it. Like, why are you? Because, you know, Kanice, first of all, back up off Kanice. Let me say that. But, you know, Kanice has a bad reputation as not academically rigorous in some of the other schools. And so people were like, well, what are you doing over there? But it made sense for me at the time for what I wanted to do. But, you know, CAS was always still at the heart of, you know, mm-hmm. my academic world, my social world. I worked there, you know, from sophomore year until I left to go to grad school. So I was a little secretary. And so it really was just an experience. And I think an experience within a college experience, you know, there's often here these debates about like, you know, HBCUs versus PWIs and what kind of experience that you're going to get. But I will say that I just feel like that I had such a nurturing and strong and vibrant Black community and Black experience at Michigan. And a lot of that was due to the history and the legacy of Black people at the University of Michigan. So that was very clear, not only from what we learned, but we also had folks coming back talking to us like, yeah, I sat up in that tower and, you know, and I told this administrator where they can go and how fast to go there. And those things were not only, again, affirming for us, but they were also training tools for us as well, because we had to I can tell the same administrator, look, you're not doing what you need to do, and it's raggedy up in here. And I don't know how many times we got to tell you it's raggedy. But though, you know, and then, you know, just what didn't work? What shouldn't we do? So I remember, I guess, was that sophomore year, Janae? I feel like it had to be sophomore year. We were boycotting the Michigan Daily. So the Michigan, you know, the Michigan Daily comes out every day. But at the time, there were not a lot of stories about Black students and Black people. And then when we were in the paper, we were often
crime reports.
Yeah, exactly. First of all, it was the crime report. That's where you could find Black, you know, it's going to be a 18 to 40 year old Black man who's between 5'5 and 6'9 and 110 to 310 pounds. So that's normally where we saw, you know, us. And then again, when there were stories about our events or our culture or programs and things like that, we were often misquoted. People were misidentified. I remember they one time confused John Matlock with
Lester Montz or something.
Well, yes. Yes, with Lester Montz. Now, okay, literally. but in a very high ranking officials within the university who the student papers should know who they are and should also know better than to misidentify them, but it wasn't the case. And so there was a lot of problems that we were having as Black students. So we were like, oh, let's boycott the Daily. And it was also the Latino students, the Asian American mm-hmm. and Pacific Islander students as well. So pretty much all the students of color. And so we were boycotting the paper. And initially we wanted to steal all of the papers. We like, let's just go around at night and steal all the papers or whatever. And so I think Brown had did that as well. And it didn't go so well from them. Brown University, some students there. So it was that kinds of things, you know, like learning from folks who had sort of been doing the activism work around strategies, how, what to say, how to say it. Mm-hmm. We learned how to call the media on the university because we found out that they don't like bad press. So you're like, call the news, call WDIV and have them come, right? But, you know, but that legacy, the, you know, those experiences, those strong, just bright, brilliant, amazing, talented Black people who went on to just do amazing things. And that's one of the other things that I just have to give a nod to from my experience as a Black student at Michigan, is that I know so many other just dope Black people who are just doing it in, you know, medicine and education and social work and entertainment out in Hollywood. I mean, any sort of field and, you know, endeavor of the human that you can think of, there are some dope Black people that I went to school with. Not just like, you know, I'm not even counting like all the Black people. I'm talking about the 4 years that I was there. And that speaks to, you know, the talent that comes to Michigan. But it also then speaks to the Black community in places like CAS, because we come into university in a very hostile place. The University of Michigan is, you know, as diverse and progressive as it wants to proclaim to be, is, as Janae said, is not a safe place for Black people. And so you can have lots of Black brilliance and have that diminished and have it beaten and, you know, worn out of you, and a lot of people go home. So the fact that we have these smart, intelligent, brilliant Black students who come in, who survive and not only survive, but thrive in that environment, then go out and still do dope stuff. Like, that says a lot to me about who we are as Black folks at Michigan. And so I always love that. I always appreciate that. And it makes me so proud to know that I'm just a part of that number of people.
Wow, that's perfect. I can't say enough about how impressed I am by all that you two have done, but also that how you're able to see yourself in this continuum. What I'd like to close with is a question that actually speaks to that. Since we have made it through our first 50 years and what is chaos to DAS, in a world that you would envision, where do you see us going? What might be some of the hopes and dreams that you all have for what lies ahead for the department?
I saw this question and I've been thinking about it. And the one thing that continues to stand out to me is just a continuation. It, to me, it's like legacy. I feel like anyone who comes through CAS and DAS, you know that number one, you're standing on the shoulders of the students who came before us and the faculty and staff who advocated for us. I mean, because we're talking a lot about the student experience, but absolutely Black faculty and staff have their own challenges and struggles and yet and still are supporting us. So knowing that you are coming in and immediately a part of this legacy of folks who are willing to, number one, be students, but also be activists and work for the collective good. I want that to continue, that to know CAS and DAS, to be a part of that is to be a part of a rich legacy. And also to continue, and it's funny because I do DEI work now. So it's one of those things where it's like, yes, I'm doing this work, but I don't believe that some magical unicorn is gonna come and make everything better and equitable by tomorrow. And so I hope that DAS continues to be that safe space for students where they can come and kind of just get refueled and nourish, and obviously play a role in figuring out how we address U of M as a system and how we address inequity, but knowing that that is not going to change overnight, still being that kind of, you know, lighthouse for Black students on campus.
And I think for me, in addition to that, I would say two things that I hope for is one, that DAS continues to grow from an interdisciplinary perspective. And so I think one of the things that I learned about my training as, you know, in CAS at the time was that it's applicable to a variety of different things, from economics to health to history to entertainment. And so continuing to grow and to help students, but also the larger society understand how the Black experience is colored by all of these different facets of
society,
but also how the Black experience influences those things and why it's important to understand Blackness and its relationship to whiteness as well in this country as we try to continue to move forward. And I think the other thing for me, so, we've also at our university been doing a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion work in our centers and our departments and our schools at the university. I keep telling people I'm DEI out at this point in time because it is a lot. And what I hope, and so because of that and sort of my resistance to that has sort of grown this thought of what does it mean to just exist as a Black person outside of the context of racism. And so Toni Morrison, she was interviewed on TV a long time ago. And one of the things that she talked about was that she says that racism is a distraction. And so she talks about this idea that if someone says that you don't have culture or you're not as smart enough, then you're going to go out there and try to prove to that person that you have culture, that you're smart, that you have history, and all of that work that you're doing to prove to someone who really has no interest in seeing your humanity anyway is then distracting you from doing the work that you were intended to do, your God's work, if you will. And so for me, I'm hoping that as we continue to grow and think about Africanic studies, like, we can never escape racism and white supremacy and sort of its impact on Black people's lives. But I want us to really think about, like, what does it mean to just live our best lives outside of the context of racism? And how do we do that? And how do we flourish and sort of build from an intra-community standpoint so that we can do our best work? Yes, we have to continue on with fighting this fight, but I also know that racism is a white people's problem. And white people have to do their work to dismantle these systems that they've built and that they continue to benefit from. And I don't want us as a race, as Black people, to continue to spend an inordinate amount of our time trying to solve something, a problem that we didn't create. And so I don't know exactly what that looks like, you know, from a curriculum standpoint, but for me, it really is about finding Black joy, defining Blackness, celebrating Blackness, and not doing it under this shroud of whiteness that's omnipresent in everything that we do.
Speak up.
Oh my goodness, I have not heard that in a minute. Oh my.
Oh, now.
But you know, I think you're absolutely right, Andre. And I'm just thinking about some of the things that have expanded since you all have left. We've now added Yoruba to our Swahili classes. Nice. You know, we're thinking and trying to think of ways of expanding. You know, we have a whole carceral project that's in the department that Heather Thompson is over, but it's so much bigger than that, because it's also about, you know, police abolition, police, you know, finding new ways of thinking about how we have been policed and informing students so that they understand that the whole police system we have now comes from the slave patrols. You know, these are things that you're not going to get when you read the newspaper every day. And so the beauty of that is something that I feel is, you know, we're seeing it grow. This term, one of our professors taught a class on Black fashion and talked about, you know, how, what an impact, just as musically, that another aspect of our creative culture has always been fashion and adornment. What does that look like? So I think that's what you're speaking to, Dre, and I think that that's something that is so, so crucial and critical, to not always have that heaviness and that burden that we carry.
Yeah.
It provides us an opportunity to really explore and expand that sense of the beauty.
I think we're still stuck in Black people were slaves. And that's, you know, like when we see, you know, even now, a lot of the TV shows and movies that are out are in some ways related to slavery, directly related to slavery, Jim Crow. And I think that, you know, it's creative in the ways they've done, you know, they're doing like horror, for example, as a genre that we've not necessarily seen as much. But I think, again, there's still the trauma of it all. And there's so much resilience and beauty and just, like I said, amazingness that is Black people. Like, this country would be just so raggedy if it wasn't for Black people and all of the things that we brought to bear in, you know, under oppressive conditions. And so for me, it's about, like, how do we celebrate those things? How do we tap into Black joy? How do we resist and still take care of ourselves at the same time? Because we've been doing those things, you know, and so we have that history, and how do we ensure that we bring it to bear as we fight these new battles, the new Jim Crow and everything else that we have to fight? we need to learn those things and also know that we don't have to be oppressed all the time. Like, it's okay to be happy. It's okay to love freely. It's okay to just be sometimes. And I feel like that so much of the time we're not allowed to do that as Black people, because at every turn in every aspect of our life, racism is coming to ruin it and be, you know, rain on our parade. And so I think it's up to us to then, as a, you know, as a intellectual body, as a community, to then figure out how do we sometimes just not let racism have its way. That's what I'm hoping that we continue to define for ourselves, and that in those approaches that we continue to grow and expand upon, so that we can live our best lives and thrive as much as possible, regardless of who don't like us because we're Black.
And I think that just leaves me to one other question that I have about, we've spoken about CAS and DAS as an entity, but what would you say to the fact that since our inception, we always were a diasporic unit as opposed to a Afro-Am unit or an African, since you all have left, we now have an African Studies Center that does primarily funding research and other programmatic things, but the fact stands that our curriculum is diasporic in nature. And what do you think are some of the, what would you say is important about the fact that it is diasporic and not just one type of study, one field?
I would say for me, I think it's important because we're all fighting the same battle. And I think that one of the tricks that oppressors play and like and have played very well is getting oppressed people to think that their situations are different, one is worse than the other. You know, and the fact of the matter is that, you know, it's all the same thing. I say all the isms, racism, sexism, homophobiaism, you know, or heterosexism, excuse me, homophobia, for example, all of those things are rooted in white supremacy and patriarchy. And so if you can understand those two systems and what they're designed and intended to do, which is essentially to elevate certain groups while putting other groups down, then you can understand that the struggles that you face, the racism, you know, the poverty, the economic oppression, all of these things that Black folks face, whether we're on the continent of Africa, here in North America, South America, somewhere in Southeast Asia, like, it's all the same thing. And so when we think about our challenges as Black people across the diaspora, all of it has to do with white supremacy and white racism. And so if we understand that, then we can be collective in our efforts. We can also understand that we're not fighting this battle alone, that some of the tools that have worked to dismantle, you know, the master's house, as they say, are useful here in the US as well as, you know, in other places. And I think you learned that. So for example, one of the things I think in CAS 101, 111, Julius's class that he taught, one of the things that we talked about is the fact that, you know, during the civil rights movement, when that was happening here in the US, you also saw quite a few countries in on the continent gaining their independence. You also saw, you know, Native American and women's rights and gay rights movements all sort of happening simultaneously because they were essentially all fighting the same system. Now, whether they recognize that or not, I don't know, but there was a certain synergy that was there as people were fighting for their rights and asserting their humanness in the country. And so I think having that diasporic perspective helps students to understand that this is all connected, that this is all the same system at work. It may look slightly different depending on where you're at geographically, but essentially it was designed to accomplish the same goals, and that's to protect the power and privilege of certain groups of people. So to me, that's the beauty, is helping people to understand that this is not some isolated incident, but it is a system, and that it is structural, and that we have to think from a structural perspective if we're really going to undo racism across the world.
So everything that Andre said, and when you ask that question, I just think about, I don't remember who asked Issa Rae this, but you know, I think it was some award show, and she pretty much was like, I'm rooting for everybody Black. And that's how I feel. Like, there is, I think by having that diasporic focus, that you then acknowledge we have a connected beginning and a connected future. And I think that, like Andre said, when we don't think that way, we lose, or we lose out on certain things. And so to make sure that we know that, yes, we might not have been born in the same country, but I believe, you know, we have the same origins. And so how do we make sure that we are staying connected, supporting each other, lifting each other up, because oftentimes we're the only ones who do it for each other. Mm-hmm. And how do we have a connected vision for our future so that we are able to move forward together. So I think it's such an appropriate focus to always have. It was important to me that I was not just an African-American studies major. I was African-American and African studies. Mm-hmm. So just having that dual focus was important to me and definitely broadened my knowledge base. So mm-hmm. something that I've always valued that DAS does.
So I have to say big ups to Niara Sudarkisa, who first thought of that. And so I want to thank you all so much for spending this time with us and taking time out of your busy schedules. I know how hard it is. Andre's at the end of the semester, and Janae, you're living in all kinds of worlds, multiple universes.
I checked out a little bit. I'll be honest about that. I'm like,
Did you? Good.
Thank you all.
Yes, thank you. It's good. And I think, again, like, you know, I really value my Michigan experience so much, and my Black Michigan experience, let me say that. And so the opportunity to just really reflect on that and just remind myself of, you know, where I'm going, because, you know, that work that I started as an 18-year-old excitable kid from Flint is the same work that I'm now doing 20 years later, with, you know, just bigger impact. And so it is helpful to be reminded that the work is ongoing, that it is a marathon, because sometimes it's difficult to stay in the fight, but also being reminded that there, again, are a whole lot of other people who are out there fighting this battle on different fronts. And so I appreciate it.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure getting to meet you and hear your takes.
It truly has been. I'm just saying, basking all this wonderfulness. It's like I'm also carrying on that legacy too. And it's like your thoughts are the thoughts that I'm having just as a 22-year-old. And I can't wait to see what they look like when I get to you all's place in life.
Absolutely.
We're an alum, you know.
You're glowing and looking gorgeous and whatnot.
I'm just saying, my 20-year class high school reunion is this year, and I'm like,
is that so?
It was just so cute the way she said it. It's like down that road,
right? Back it down yonder, over the hill,
then easing down the road like Dorothy. Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! It's so beautiful, though. My goodness! Yeah, so is. I'm turning off the recording before we say something crazy.
You should have never turned it on.